You're listening to a UC San Diego podcast.
Okay. I think we can get going. All right. It's loud enough. No, not really. Is that working? I can turn it up. That is maximally loud. You hear me at the back? Is that okay? Yeah? All right, so hope the homework's going great. There's one more office hour on Friday if you want to catch up on any last-minute details. And then next week, just bring it into class or drop it outside my office beforehand. So I think we can just pick up from exactly where we left off on Monday. We'd finished looking at SVMs, and we started looking through a real example where we wanted to try and sort of judge a book by its cover. So we're trying to do something a bit funny, like given some data set of book images. In this case, this is 5,000 book images from Amazon. We'd like to identify which of those are children's books versus which of those are not, based on their visual appearance. Okay, so we loaded up that data set. We built some feature matrix consisting of the image features for every one of those images. And we saw that we get features something like this. I mean, don't worry too much about what these features are. I don't know what they are either. They're essentially the output of some black box, state-of-the-art, 4,000-dimensional image descriptor. So it's going to describe things like color features, edge features, whether or not the image contains a face, who knows what. And we'd like to find which of those things are going to be useful at discriminating children's books from non-children's books. So, you know, we followed best practices. We split our data up into a training set and a test set, each of which contains 2,500 elements. We trained the SVM. I won't make you sit through it again because it takes about a minute. And we ran our predictions on the training and test set. And, okay, so we won't give it away just yet. We ran our classifier. And we found that, okay, on the training data, you got everything right, so 2,500 out of 2,500 points were classified correctly as being children's books or not children's books. And we thought, okay, we know better than that. We know about overfitting now. Let's see how well it works on the test set. Okay, so I think it seemed to work pretty well. The accuracy was 2,401, so it was still 96% accuracy on the test set. And I sort of left us with the cliffhanger. You know, people came up to me after class, they said, wow, that's amazing. Can you really train a classifier that's 96% accurate that basically distinguishes books based on their cover art using only 2,500 training images? Well, no, of course you can't, unfortunately. So who spots the problem? Is 96% good? Are we happy? Yeah? No, it sucks. So, you know, here's another classifier. All this does is predict false all the time. So I'm just saying, okay, my classification is always false. So rather than saying, is the test prediction equal to the test label, I just say, is the test label equal to my prediction, which is always false? And okay, I get 2,405. That's better, right? So what's that number? 96.2. I increased my accuracy from 96 to 96.2 just by predicting false all the time. So yeah, see the problem now? Can you express the problem as a sentence? Yeah, basically. There are no children's books. I guess there are only 3.8% of books are children's books, so I can get 3.8% error just by saying nothing is a children's book. So, okay, I have a useless classifier that somehow looks like it's a useful classifier. That's kind of the problem we want to address today. So, you know, in second lecture, when we talk about regression, we talked about diagnostics. How can we evaluate whether a regressor is actually doing something sensible or not? Today, we were looking at the same thing for classification. So how can we come up with subtler or more complicated evaluation measures that say whether a binary classifier is really doing something sensible beyond just trying to measure its predictive accuracy or the fraction of times it got things correct, which is apparently a bit too coarse-grained. Okay, so where are we? I mean, how are things so far? So, okay, one quick announcement. Yes, there'll be office hours, 12 p.m. on Friday. We don't have a location yet, so check Piazza. Hopefully that's posted by the end of today. But where did we get? So this week we're looking at these sort of categorical types of predictions. We want to infer functions that look like this. We're given some data, or we're trying to predict the label, or we're trying to learn the function that goes from the data to the label. That's all of supervised learning. That's all of week one and week two. And in the case of classification, we care about output variables that look like this, binary valued or categorical. And we didn't do much for categorical. We just said, well, if you have n classes, just train n binary classifiers and say whichever of them returns the highest score, we're going to use that one as our categorical label. So if you want to identify whether an image contains a duck, train your cat classifier, train your dog classifier, train your aardvark classifier, train your everything classifier, and then whichever one of those classifiers returns the highest probability or the highest score with an SVM, that's the one of these N classes that you'll pick. Okay, so we have, you know, a fairly powerful set of models now where we can do, we can solve problems of this type where our label might be a real value quantity, it might be a binary quantity, or it might be a categorical quantity. So, you know, what can we do with this type of model? We can do things like purchase prediction, so the equivalent to predicting a person's, much like we predicted ratings using things like demographics and information about the movie, we can predict binary quantities like whether you'd purchase it or not. Same thing for predicting whether or not you might click on an ad. And yeah, same thing for things like categorical prediction, where we can just train a predictor of this sort, goes from a query to a label drawn from a finite set just by training like a bank of binary classifiers. And, you know, the example in the homework, deciding, given some textual description of a book, extract a few features from the text that can be used to predict its category, something along those lines. Okay, so what did we see on Monday? We saw these three models, which are three different ways of classifying binary outputs with their various advantages and disadvantages. Naive Bayes is kind of the simplest. It's about the most powerful model you can come up with if all you're allowed to do is count observations of features and labels. So it makes this very simple conditional independence assumption that says if we know the label, then it makes the features independent. And it seems like a funny thing to do, but this very simple rule allows you to decompose your probability into independent terms that only consider one feature at a time. So all you've got to do is count instances of a feature and a label, do this for every feature you care about, aggregate those counts in a very simple way, and that gives you some prediction. Okay? Very simple model. We saw that it suffers from this one issue, which is one like double counting. So if you have two features that did not satisfy this sort of very strong conditional independence assumption, like the ones we saw were, does a book mention witches and does a book mention wizards, given that it's a children's book, those are not independent features. Naive Bayes doesn't make a lot of sense, so we use logistic regression to try and address this problem. It's basically exactly the same as regular regression, except that it's replacing the real valued output with a number between 0 and 1, which corresponds to probability. Third, SVMs, they're kind of an alternate way of optimizing the same type of task. But here, we care about, or we really want to focus on the most difficult parts of the model to classify. So the intuition I kind of gave was that with linguistic regression, every single training instance wants to push that classification boundary as far away from it as it can possibly get. It wants to be classified correctly with the highest possible prediction. And we saw that this can be a little bit dangerous if there's a huge number of easy to classify examples and a small number of hard to classify examples, which can be a fairly realistic scenario. In that case, all of those easy to classify examples, they kind of outweigh the difficult ones. They get to vote too much, and the really hard examples, they don't even count in the model, so they get misclassified. SVMs try and address that particular problem by saying, look, if a point's correctly classified by enough, it can just take it easy. It doesn't have to fight for the classification boundary to be further away. It can say, I'm happy. I'm going to let those difficult to classify examples that are close to the decision boundary determine the model. So here, you're trying to maximize some probability. Here, you're trying to minimize the number of misclassifications directly. So yeah, all three of these classifiers, very similar. They're all doing something like this. They're all adding up the contribution of a bunch of different features weighted by some term theta, and then using some threshold to decide whether that makes the decision positive or negative. So they're all like what you'd call linear classification functions. The features just add up their own contribution determined by theta to decide whether the label should be positive or negative. The only difference is really in how we determine theta. They're just three different schemes for deciding what theta ought to be. Okay, so yeah, what do we have? Naive Bayes makes a simple assumption that allows you to decompose this probability into independent terms. We had linguistic regression, which takes regular regression like this, passes it through a sigmoid, converts the output to a probability. And we had support vector machines that try to directly focus on the most difficult to classify instances, whereas linguistic regression is going to sort of end up with something in the middle because this kind of data set is dominated by a huge number of easy to classify points. Okay, so just to sort of hammer the morals home one last time, these are the kind of advantages and disadvantages between the models we've seen so far. Naive Bayes, yeah, has the double counting issue I mentioned. The advantage of it is that it's just a really, really super trivial, incredibly scalable model. Now, I guess the way I presented Naive Bayes in class made it look kind of ridiculous. I kind of used it in a case where it shouldn't be used, right? I used it in a case where this this conditional independent statement that Naive Bayes assumes was obviously false. So it was kind of the wrong model to apply. Naive Bayes is not that bad. It's Naive Bayes is fantastic. People use Naive Bayes. It's a great way to deal with incredibly high dimensional features. You just have to ensure that this assumption is true. You have to ensure that you do actually have features that are conditionally independent given the label. And that's something we'll come back to later. Like when we look at dimensionality reduction, we find ways to automatically discover good features from very high dimensional data. Something like PCA, for instance, which we'll see next week, is automatically finding kind of orthogonal or independent feature dimensions amongst high dimensional data. If you're using features like that, well, Naive Bayes becomes a pretty sensible model. You can pretty confidently make these independent statements, then you can use a very trivial model that's very scalable and it's going to work pretty well. Okay, so it's not as bad as I made it look. Linguistic regression fixes that issue. On the downside, it's more expensive. And finally, SVMs, well, they're more expensive again. And the good thing about them is they directly optimize that measure you probably care about. If what you want to optimize really is the accuracy rather than some likelihood, which you hope is a proxy for the accuracy, then SVMs are kind of the right thing. Okay, so those are the pros and cons of all of them. someone was asking me earlier, why use logistic regression if you can afford to use an SVM? You know, this seems to be what we want. It seems that most of the time we would want to optimize the classification error. But something we'll see a lot more of in this class is this notion of probabilistic models. So this basic idea behind logistic regression was that we could write down some probability. We could write down what's the probability of the label given the data. Okay? If you can write that down, this function could be whatever you like. If you can write it down, then all you've got to do is take a derivative, climb in the correct direction, you've got your model. This doesn't have to be a linear classifier like logistic regression was in the last lecture. It's an arbitrary, ridiculously complicated model, but it's just this very powerful framework where if you can write down a probability, take a derivative, you can develop any kind of model you want. This kind of reasoning doesn't quite apply to SVMs in the same way. If you have some nonlinear decision function, coming up with the equivalent of an SVM for that function is very difficult, whereas this is very easy. So, you know, later on, when we look at recommender systems, when we look at text modeling, this is going to turn out to be a very powerful idea. Just trying to write down, okay, what's the probability that a person would use this certain word in a document? We can come up with really complicated expressions for that. But, you know, we can compute derivatives, so we can build models. Okay, so that's where we are so far. What are we doing today? One thing is we're going to look at a simple classifier that I didn't get around to covering on Monday, which is called just nearest neighbors, which is based on measuring distances between labeled and unlabeled instances. And secondly, really what we're going to look at is how you can evaluate whether a classifier is good or not. Rather than just looking at the binary accuracy, can you look at something more subtle, like what can you do when there's lots of imbalance between positive and negative samples? What can you do when you only care about the top ranked? Or what can you do where errors are very costly in one direction? I think it's not too much to cover in one day, so we should get to a case study. That'll be lots of fun. And that's also kind of why I'm talking about nearest neighbor classification, because that's what the case study is really going to be about. Okay, so, yeah. What is this one more classifier that was so important that I needed to come back to it today and mention it? Couldn't get much simpler than this. Here's our training set like we've had the whole time. Here's our test instance. How do we classify it? We just find the nearest point. Okay? So, you know, I don't need to spend much more time on that. We'll come back to it as long as we make it to the case study. All we're doing here is saying, I'm going to take the distance from my test point to all of the training examples, and I'm going to look at the label of that nearest point. Okay? So we'll come back to that later. On to the main event. Everyone's happy with where we are now? Any pressing questions? Okay, let's power forward. So, you know, like I kind of suggested, maybe we want to do something a bit more complicated than just counting the number of errors in order to determine whether a classifier is good or not. So, which of these classifiers might be better? Who votes for A? Take a moment to think about it. A's getting a few votes. Who votes for B? B is getting a few more votes. So we think B is better than A. Well, okay, let's think about why. So, A makes how many errors? 2. B makes how many? 5, yeah, okay. So, sort of naively, based on what we had in the code from Monday, we would think A is the better classifier, has the highest accuracy, you know, makes 2 out of, I don't know, 40 errors or whatever. B is somehow less accurate, and yet people voted for it, so why do we like B? Okay, so, yeah, I mean, you're on the right track. It's not a function of the error, but it's a function of the two types of error. Okay, so we need some kind of error measure that considers the stars and the peppers separately. If we treat them both equally, then naturally we're going to let the peppers dominate. The stars aren't going to do much. But really, we have, in this case, we have two star errors and zero pepper errors. I can't really draw a pepper. And in this case, we have zero star errors and five pepper errors. I guess what's more important is the fraction. This is two out of four. This is zero out of, I'm not going to count them, say 30. And this is zero out of four. And this is five out of 30. So, you know, somehow what we'd like to do is say, well, this class is much, much rarer. So we'd like to somehow treat errors in this rare class as being more important than errors in this incredibly common class. And that's exactly what happened in this example with the children's books. I mean, you can think about an even more trivial case. If I had one more classifier, C, seems to be a pretty useless classifier, but it only makes four mistakes, right? So this is essentially what we ended up with. This is the classifier that predicts false all the time. This is that classifier that's almost useless, but somehow seemed good before we knew better. But this is the classifier that maybe we actually want, even though its accuracy is lower. So can we come up with some error measure? Can we come up with some optimization scheme that's going to allow us to identify the fact that this is the better classifier and actually optimize our predictions or optimize our model or our training scheme such that this classifier is actually the one that will be chosen. All right? So, yeah, moral of the story, the solution with the fewest errors is not necessarily the best. So when is this going to be the case? The first example, which we saw, is when you have this really terrible class imbalance. So like with children's books or whatever, typically it's going to be the case that there's some extremely small number of whatever the positive class is and some extremely large number of whatever the negative class is, right? So you can imagine I want to train some model to distinguish items that I would purchase on Amazon versus items that I would not purchase on Amazon. Now there's 10 million items on Amazon. There's a few dozen that I might purchase. So, you know, you want to train a classifier that focuses on those few things I actually would like. So just predicting false for everything, it's 99.999% accurate, but it's useless. What you really want is something that's going to identify a few items that I would purchase, and if it throws in a few that I wouldn't, it doesn't really matter. Okay? So somehow accuracy on the positive examples is going to be much more important than accuracy on the negative examples. The second case, which is kind of a similar thing, is where you have very costly mistakes in one direction and relatively cheaper mistakes in the other direction. This is the example I showed on Monday. Maybe you're trying to find dangerous goods in a bag. Now, if the true label, if the label is false, the prediction is true. In other words, if the bag doesn't contain anything dangerous, but you predict it does, okay, it doesn't matter. It's a bit of a nuisance, wastes a bit of time, it's not very costly. If the bag does contain something dangerous and you predict false, then that's terrible. So somehow, again, even though true instances are extremely rare, you'd like some error measure that guarantees that you find all of the true instances, and if it throws in a few false instances, it doesn't matter too much. And the third, which is, again, a variation on the same theme, is say you care about some kind of ranking task. So say you only care about those predictions about which you have the highest confidence. So this is the kind of error measure we might care about if we were doing something like search. You're given some query, and then for every single web page in the vocabulary, you'd like to make a binary prediction that says, is that web page relevant to the query, yes or no? So here, you can imagine what you really have is a fixed budget or something like that for how many results you can return. On Google, you care about what happens in the first 10 results. As long as a few of those are relevant you're happy. What happens for results 11 to 10 billion doesn't matter that much. So you want some kind of error measure that assigns more weight to items that are very close to the top or those about which you're most confident they'll have a positive label. Okay, so what do we have? We have some kind of classification function. We have our positive points or peppers, and we have our negative points or stars, and we'd like to come up with some measure that allows us to evaluate this thing. Now, sort of intuitively, what we said is that we need to treat the accuracy we get on the positive instances and the accuracy we get on the negative instances separately, so that we can account for the fact that there might be different numbers of the two things. So we come up with these four kind of quantities. You've probably seen these before in statistics or something. We have true positives, so those are things that are labeled as positive. Predicate is, positive. True negative, same idea. Well, I guess I can draw those just to make it absolutely dead clear. These are the positive instances that we thought were positive. True negative, those are the negative instances that we correctly identified as being negative. Those are going to be over here. What's left? False positives. So those are the ones that we thought they were positive. They're actually negative. So those are going to be the ones on the right of the decision boundary that actually have negative labels. And finally, false negative. All right? I won't ask you. I'll just write it down. Those are labeled as positive, we predicted them negative, and those are these two here. Okay, so we kind of have these four quantities that are that allow us to determine accuracy for positive and accuracy for negatively labeled points separately. So just to quickly abbreviate, we sort of have this grid of our true positives, false positives, false negatives, and true negatives. All right, and like we said, what we'd kind of like to do is come up with some error measure that accounts for the imbalance between the two classes. So what have we been doing so far? Just looking at the classification accuracy. So here we're just taking all these different labels, true and false, we're just throwing them together. So all we care about is the number of correct predictions divided by the total number of predictions. So this is what we've been working with so far, which is the number of true positives plus the number of true negatives divided by the total number of predictions. What's that? That's true positives plus true negatives plus false positives plus false negatives. Okay, that's classification accuracy. Error rates, basically the same thing, just with the mistakes rather than the correct predictions. So false negatives, what is this? False negatives plus false positives divided by, same thing, true positives, true negatives plus false positives plus false negatives. Okay. This is all we've worked with up until now. So what can we do that's a bit better? Is basically to treat these two quantities separately. So to come up with one error rate for the positively labeled instances and one error rate for the negatively labeled instances. So this is the fraction of the positively labeled test samples that we correctly identified as being positively labeled. So true positives divided by everything labeled positive. What are the things that are labeled positive? True positives, and what else? False positives, yeah. Not too complicated. So same thing for true negatives. That's true negatives divided by everything labeled negative. So whatever's left over, that's the true negatives plus the false negatives. Okay. So then both of these are numbers between 0 and 1, saying how well did we do on each of the two classes separately. And these are called the sensitivity and specificity. I don't know if those words make much sense intuitively, but if you think about it, say you're trying to identify dangerous baggage from safe baggage, or you're trying to identify sick people from healthy people, then this is saying how many of the sick did we identify as being sick? That's a sensitivity. And specificity is saying how many of the healthy did we identify as being healthy? And, you know, there's kind of a fundamental trade-off between those two goals, right? You can predict... You can find all of the sick people if you just say everyone is sick, but it's not very useful. So, first error measure we can come up with to address this class imbalance is something like the balanced error rate. Okay, we have these two quantities. Well, okay, what we saw previously was a true positive rate and the true negative rate. This is the false positive rate and the false negative rate, which is just the opposite, the errors rather than accuracy. And we'll just balance the two. We'll say each of these two things counts for half. We want to be the average of the accuracy on the negative examples and the accuracy on the positive examples. So that both of the two classes, regardless of how imbalanced they may be, ought to count equally. So that's a very simple measure that would kind of address these problems we've seen so far with the book classification example. That's what we try to do in the homework, actually, by sort of splitting up the data set so that we have some kind of balance between positive and negative instances. But how will we do this for something like a probabilistic classifier? So, I mean, in other words, we now know how to measure whether our algorithm is good on both positive and negative classes. How can we actually train a classifier, though, that's going to be good at this measure? So this is our regular logistic regressor from Monday's lecture. We've already said it could suffer from this issue of class imbalance. So how do we fix that? So, you know, this is the likelihood function. We can write down the log likelihood. So the sum over all the positive examples. Of the log of the sigmoid function. And all of the negative examples of the log of 1 minus the sigmoid function. Okay, so this is our regular objective that we're trying to maximize. And we've said it suffers from this class imbalance problem. And it's pretty easy here to see why. So if we have a tiny number of positively labeled examples and a huge number of negatively labeled examples, then this term just is going to dominate the objective, right? These count for very little. These count for everything. So that's kind of what we'd like to correct. So there are two ways. One is basically what you're doing in the homework. So this is homework one. You just balance, or I guess you just sample. You sample the training set so that the two classes are balanced. So here you'd say, I want to generate a sample such that the number of positively labeled instances is equal to the number of negatively labeled instances. You know, that's what I'm asking you to do in the homework, right? So that's going to solve this problem. I mean, that means that this term is kind of going to count for as much as this term does. Is there anything we don't like about this solution? I mean, it's definitely optimizing the balanced error rate, right? What's bad about it? Yeah? Yeah, exactly. I mean, we've already said the reason we're doing this is because we'd like to fix this problem of class imbalance. So in other words, probably these positively labeled instances are incredibly rare, these negatively labeled instances are incredibly common, and to fix it, I'm just going to throw away most of my negative instances. So in this case where I had only 3.8% of my data set being children's books, I said I'm going to keep this 3.8% and I'm going to take 3.8% from here too. So I end up using only 7.6% of my data and throwing away the vast majority of it. So, yeah, if class imbalance is really bad, well, this is going to fix the imbalance problem, but now I have another problem, which is that I may not have enough data left over for training. I'd like to use all of my negatively labeled instances, since there's so many of them, and their features presumably tell me a lot. So the other solution is that we can try and kind of balance these two terms. So you have some expression that looks like this. Say you have A positive examples, and you have B negative examples. Then what we'd like to do is just reweight these two things so that the contribution from the left-hand side is equal to the contribution from the right-hand side. So not very difficult. Divide the first one by A, divide the second one by B. All right, so essentially all that's doing is taking this term, so the objective for all the negatively labeled instances, average it, take this term, the objective for all the positively labeled instances, average that, and then sum the two together. So by averaging both terms, I'm guaranteeing that the two of them have equal contribution to the objective. So I'm keeping every single term in my data set, but I'm assigning the rare class relatively higher weight than the common class so that their weight is balanced. Yeah? With me? I think so. All right. So that's one problem solved. We have this class imbalance. We'd like to train things like logistic classifiers to address it. So that's how you would reweight the terms in a logistic regressor to account for the balance imbalance between positive and negative examples. What else did we want to do? We wanted to look at ranking tasks. So we wanted to consider cases where what we really care about is those points that are ranked near the top. So just to convince yourselves, you know, all these classifiers we've seen so far can be used for ranking tasks because all of them associate scores with their predictions. So what that really means is that all of them have some kind of a decision boundary and we can measure the distance of every single point from that decision boundary. So somehow, I mean, this point is one we're really not sure about. It's very close to the boundary, whereas this point is one we're incredibly confident that it's negative, and its score is going to be something like that. So we have the most confident positively labeled point and the most confident negatively labeled point, or just the least confident point, if you like. Yeah? You're least confident that it's positively labeled, and you're most confident that it's negatively labeled. Yes. I guess it depends how you're thinking about it. If your goal is to take a bunch of web pages and say which of them are relevant, I'd say I'm most confident this one is relevant, and I am least confident this one is relevant. If you think about it as labeling dogs from non-dogs, I'd say I'm most confident this is a dog and I'm most confident this is not a dog, or I'm least confident that it is a dog. Yeah, it's just semantics. You get the idea. Yep. Yeah, I mean, it depends. Maybe I shouldn't have even written these labels. This is the one we're least confident that it's positively labeled. It's very unlikely this has a positive label. This is the one where we're, or this is the one where we're least confident about its label. Yeah? But it depends what you're doing. Like, if you care about finding the topmost positive and the topmost negative, then yeah, you care about the absolute value of this score, of your distance from the decision boundary in the positive or negative direction. If you just care about positive things, then you care about just the raw signed distance. Okay? All right. Anyway, the sort of point is that for these ranking type tasks, we don't really care about the labels of the points anymore. We just care about the ranking of the distance from the boundary. So which of them are we most confident about? Which are we least confident about? And all that we really care about is that the positive ones ought to get higher ranks than the negative ones. Or the ones we want to return to the user, the relevant pages or something like that, should be ranked higher than the irrelevant pages. So, yeah, we have such a concept for every classifier we've seen. For naive Bayes, it's just this probability ratio. So we can measure the probability between the data having a positive label and a negative label. It's going to be predict true if the number is greater than 1 or whatever. We can just rank things by this number. That corresponds to how confident we are that the label is positive. For logistic regression, it's just the probability. So how close is that to 1? And for SVM, it's the distance from the decision boundary. Yeah? And the confidence scores? Yeah, kind of. I mean, with the balanced error measure, we have this sort of fundamental trade-off between sensitivity and specificity, right? Like I said, you can easily find all the sick people if you just predict everyone's sick. So we're going to see the same kind of trade-off for ranking-type tasks with these two notions called precision and recall. So you have these two concepts, which says, say I'm going to allow you to return some fixed number of web pages, then there are two things you care about. One is how many of your predictions are good, and two is how many of the good predictions did you return? Okay? So it's the same kind of concept. You want to have a measure that's good at finding, or that correctly puts the good things near the top, and you want a measure that finds all of the good things. There'll be a slide. But yeah, there are the equivalent two quantities that get traded off with this ranking type task. So this is essentially what we're doing when we're ranking. We're computing these confidence scores, which are just, I don't know, they're arbitrary numbers that you can sort. And all we care about is whether the high scores, the high confidences, appear closer to the top of the ranking than the low confidences. And, you know, getting to these questions that were being asked a minute ago, depending on my task, I might want to sort by absolute value, or I might just want to sort. So that is a question of whether I care about both the most confident positive and the most confident negative, in which case I'd sort by absolute value, or whether I just care about the most confident positive, which is what you would have for something like a search engine. So yeah, what really matters is that the high confidence ones have the correct label. To make this a bit more obvious, I can write the labels directly below these scores. So all I'm doing is copying Y here. 1, 1, 1, -1, 1, 1, -1, 1. Okay, I can sort these things, of course. What do I have? 1.4, which is a 1. 1.3, which is a 1. 1.0, that's 1. 0.8, that's 1. 0.6, that seems to run pretty well so far. That's 1. What's next? 0.1. Okay, that's negative 1. So we're starting to return the bad examples. Minus 0.1, okay? That's 1. Minus 0.2, that's negative 1. I think I'm almost done here. Minus 0.4, that's 1. Minus 0.8, that's negative 1. Okay, that was exciting, wasn't it? We've sorted our values, and we've put the corresponding labels next to them. And really all we care about is whether the positive instances, the good instances, appear near the top of the ranking. At this point, we can actually just sort of throw out the numbers themselves. All we care about is in what order were the good and the bad predictions returned, and we'd like to come up with some quantitative measure of the extent to which the good instances were near the front. Okay, so there's our labels sorted by confidence with the actual numbers, with the actual confidence scores thrown away. So the first case is maybe we're given some fixed budget. This would be sort of a very, you know, search engine type measure where you're allowed to return, say, six or some fixed budget of search results, and you'd like to say, okay, of that number I was allowed to return, how many were good? So, I don't know, in this data set there were seven relevant items. We got to return six, and five of those were relevant. So maybe you want to say, okay, we got an accuracy of something like 5/6 for this task. This would be the type of task where I'm just saying, all I care about is that amongst the fixed set of results that I was allowed to return, as many of those were good as possible. What happened afterwards and where the other ones and negative ones appear in the rest of the list doesn't matter to me at all. So this notion is captured by what's called the precision. Okay? So you retrieved some set of documents. That's your kind of fixed budget. We were allowed to retrieve six things. And then on the numerator, we have how many of those things that we retrieved turned out to be relevant. So we got 5 out of 6. So on the numerator, we have, got 5 out of 7. In the numerator, we have 5 from the intersection. So 5 of the 6 things we returned were relevant. That's the precision. On the other hand, you have recall, which is very closely related, except the denominator here is now the number of relevant documents. So that's the fraction of relevant things you retrieved. In this case, we had 7 total relevant documents, and the numerator is the same. We retrieved 5 of them. So coming back to the previous question, these are the kind of the two things we might be trading off in a ranking task. The number of retrieved documents, this is kind of our budget or some threshold that we set for how much we can afford to return. And we can compute these two things, and we'd like the things we return to be good, and we'd like to return as many of the good things as possible. So an ideal classifier is one that says, look, here are the 150 web pages about which I'm most confident. All of them are relevant, and there are no more relevant things amongst the next 10 billion web page. That would be one that has precision of 1 and a recall of 1. But you can see how there's this trade-off, right? I can easily get a recall of 1. I just return everything. Getting a recall of 1, and I can relatively easily get a precision that's close to 1. I can just say, what is the 1 web page about which I'm extremely confident, I'm just going to return that. And that's going to maximize my precision, but I've only returned 1 of potentially many relevant things. So there's my sort of trade-off in a ranking task. I want relevant things to be returned, but I want to sort of cover the full space of relevant things to the extent possible. The precision at K is just, what is this precision once I'm given a fixed budget, once I set retrieve to be equal to 6 or however many results I can show on a web page, what does the precision look like then? So in this case, the precision at 6 was just 5/6. Okay, so I said in answer to that question, there is this fundamental trade-off. The F score and the F beta score are then ways of kind of balancing these two things when we might care about those two concepts. Or we might care about one of those concepts more than the other. So we have this trade-off between returning all of the relevant things versus having those things we return being mostly relevant. So F1 score is just a simple harmonic mean of those two concepts. The F-beta score, which is maybe the more interesting one, allows us to assign more weight to one than the other. So, I mean, think about that problem of finding dangerous goods in baggage again. What we really care about here is recall, right? Amongst all of our items, we want all of the dangerous ones to be returned. And we're willing to sacrifice some precision. We're willing for some non-dangerous things to be returned as well. But moral of the story is recall is much, 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 much more important than precision for a task like that. So the F-beta score is some error measure that allows you to set how accurate you consider recall to be compared to precision. So higher beta means you're assigning higher weight to recall. Okay. In practice, I mean, what people often evaluate or what they show is kind of the spectrum. So you can imagine I'm given some fixed budget of how many things I can return, and I can say, if I'm going to rank that many things by confidence, what was my recall and what was my precision? So then you can say, okay, what was my precision when I could return only one thing? What was my precision when I could return 10 things? And you kind of look at the spectrum. And what you'd like is this kind of decays gracefully. Like, when my precision is incredibly high and maybe if I'm just returning one thing, then I got incredibly high precision but low recall, and it's eventually going to go down until I'm just recommending or returning every single thing, so the precision is going to be equal to the fraction of examples that are positively labeled. Actually, if you try plotting one of these things, it's going to have some slightly funny sawtooth shape, which I can't really draw with a pen. But anyway, what actually happens is if, say, I have some fixed precision in recall, if I return some additional irrelevant result, then my recall stays the same, but my precision goes down. And this keeps happening until I return the next relevant result. Okay? I mean, you can think that through. You can try plotting one of these things, convince yourself that the curve looks like kind of like this, and see why. Okay, so that's kind of it for evaluating classifiers. I think we have plenty of time to move on to a case study. But the morals of the story is you have these three cases. One is where your data set is highly imbalanced between the positive and negative class. One is which you care more about one type of error than another. And one is in which you only care about the top rank predictions. What kind of evaluation measures should you use if those are your goals? So if you have some really highly imbalanced data set, maybe you want to compute something like the true positive and the true negative rate, and that allows you to compute something like the balanced error rate. And then you can train your logistic regressor to optimize the average of the error on positive labels and the error on negative labels. F1 score is getting at the same thing. It's looking at the mean of precision and recall. The second case, when you have much more costly mistakes in one direction, that's what the F-beta score kind of addresses. You can sort of set the weight that determines how much do I care about returning everything versus how much do I care about those things I returned being relevant. And, you know, the third thing is if we care about the most confident predictions, then we can kind of plot or report this spectrum that says, as I return more things, how does that impact my precision and recall scores? Okay, so where are we in this class? We've done regression, so we've seen how we can use features to predict real valued outputs like a movie rating or a beer rating given user demographics and item properties. We've seen this notion of Occam's razor, which we can use to sort of correct for overfitting. Like we have this prior model in our head that says complex explanations for data tend to be less likely than simple explanations if both work approximately equally well, so we should favor the simpler ones in order to improve our generalization accuracy. And finally, in week one, we saw this idea of kind of diagnosing regressors and saying, you know, where does this assumption to use the mean squared error actually come from? How can we come up with this notion of a probabilistic predictor and say, well, this is actually equivalent to assuming that my errors are normally distributed. And then how can we kind of evaluate our decision to make that assumption and determine whether errors really are normally distributed. And then this week, we looked at classification. So we generalized these ideas from, not really generalized, we altered these ideas from regression to binary and discrete output or categorical output. And we saw three models to do this, naive Bayes, logistic regression, and SVMs. Okay, so that's where we are so far. We've kind of done supervised learning. Next week, we'll move on to dimensionality reduction. So this is what we're going to say about trying to infer functions that go from data to labels. And everything we looked at has been like this. We've looked at essentially linear models for prediction. Okay, so all of our models, regression and classification, looked exactly like this. We have a bunch of features. We're assigning weights to every one of these dimensions. In the case of regression, the combination of the features and weights gives us the label directly. In the case of classification, we also incorporate some sort of thresholding function. But then all of these different algorithms we've seen are just different ways for choosing theta depending what our goals are. Okay, so like I said, I'll do a case study. Are there any more burning questions about everything up to the end of week two, which is, I guess, what you need to do all the homeworks? No? Everyone's happy? Then let us talk about clothing recommendation. Who here buys all their clothes from Amazon? Just me. Yeah. Okay, a few people do. You know, it's my favorite way to buy clothes. It's how I buy absolutely everything. I don't like going shopping for clothing. So I value a lot these recommendations that Amazon provides. And naturally I thought, okay, can we build algorithms to make these recommendations automatically based on, say, the visual concept of these product images? So the extent to which I'm stylistically challenged, can I come up with some algorithm that's going to learn the concept of style for me and then provide good recommendations of products that might be compatible? So if you've been to the Amazon website, you've seen the kind of recommendations it provides. You click on a pair of jeans, it recommends you a bunch of other products that people have also viewed with those jeans and a bunch of products that people have also bought with those jeans. So those are things that maybe you're likely to click on or likely to add to the same basket. Those are things we'd like to sort of automatically infer. So given some complete vocabulary of all products or all products within a particular category, like women's clothing, we'd like to sort of fill in this graph. We'd like to say for every single pair of products, which of them are likely to be browsed together and which of them are likely to be bought together. All right? So why would you want to do this? First, this will kind of allow you to learn the notion of what makes goods substitutable or complementary. So things like items that might be browsed together during the same session, that's some up to some noise, that's some loosely defined notion that two things are substitutable. And given that two things might be bought together in the same session, that means they might be complementary. So, you know, if you understand these concepts, that might allow you to design something like a better recommender system. It says, while a person is browsing for an item like this one, we should recommend items like that one. But once they buy it, we should start recommending things like complements instead. We should say, you don't want to buy similar items, but maybe you want to buy things that would go together. You could also use such a model, if you can learn these concepts, to generate things like outfit recommendations, to recommend sets of goods, all of which are mutually compatible and would be likely to be purchased together. So like I said, we collected some huge data set from Amazon to do this. We have sort of millions of products, tens of millions of users, loads and loads of reviews, which we don't really use right now, but we'll come back to that in some other class. And more importantly, here we have these millions and millions of relationships between images or between products. Say, what was co-purchased and what was co-browsed? So this is exactly what Amazon actually gives you. They give you these four sets of recommendations You know, people who viewed X viewed Y. People who viewed X eventually bought Y. People who bought X also bought Y. People bought X and Y together. The differences between these four things are kind of subtle. Like this refers to, I don't know, a single basket. This refers to multiple sessions. But the important notions here is we have this one idea of substitutes. So half the edges are substitutable items, and the other half are complementary items. And those are the two quantities we'd like to distinguish. Okay, so, you know, this is sort of the example of the kind of virtues of a good data mining problem, yeah? What's the difference between 3 and 4? So, as far as I remember, 4 is one basket. You clicked buy when both X and Y were in the basket together. X is the same... 3 is the same user, but possibly on different days. So, you know, this is probably the strongest signal, but there's much more of this one. Well, I don't know. I mean, sometimes you do buy two pairs of socks from Amazon. They're not really complementary. But up to some noise, these two encode complements. So, yeah, we talked about, like, the virtues of what we want to do in data mining problems back in week one. We want some prediction task. In this case, we're trying to estimate what would be co-purchased or co-browsed. We want some model to solve this predictive task. In this case, the model is going to consist of understanding this notion of compatible visual styles, or, you know, trying to use visual features to learn this notion of compatibility. And three, we want to make some hopefully interpretable statements about what's actually going on. So can we actually understand the visual dimensions that people consider when they're buying things? So why use images to do this? One and two is that people use visual data to make these kind of decisions themselves. You know, you would never go on Amazon to buy a T-shirt if you couldn't see the T-shirt. Wouldn't matter how many reviews you could read. Wouldn't matter what star rating it has. You make that decision based on visual factors, so we ought to use visual factors in the predictor. The other reason is what's called cold start problems. So the way Amazon makes his recommendations currently, which I'll mention in a little bit, is just by using previous users' browsing and co-purchase data. So if some clothing item had never been purchased before, it was newly introduced, then they would have no way of recommending it because there are no users who previously clicked or purchased it. So if you have some system that makes use of the content, like the image itself, it can make these recommendations even for brand new things. So we'll cast this as like a binary prediction task where we want to associate a probability with this question. What is the probability that X and Y are related to each other, which could mean complementary or it could mean substitutable, depending on which training set you use. And we're going to try and learn this notion of relatedness from data. So this is kind of getting at this idea that these types of probabilistic models are going to be very powerful. So we're not just going to use straightforward logistic regression. We're going to use some weird nonlinear model. But the moral of the story is, as long as we can write down a probability like this, it doesn't matter how complicated our model is. As long as we can compute its derivative, we're good to go. We can do kind of the same thing we've been doing with logistic regression up until now. We can build some training set which consists of positive pairs, things that were co-purchased, and negative pairs, things that weren't co-purchased. We'd like the probability to be as high as possible for real co-purchases and as low as possible for non-co-purchases, right? That's our objective. As long as we can compute its derivative, we can easily optimize it for whatever strange parameterization theta we might use. Okay, so what do we actually have as input to this problem? We have the products, X and Y, and their associated image features. Again, I won't say much about features, except we get them off the shelf. This is exactly the same features I was talking about in class the other day. Just 4,096 dimensional representations that are output from some state-of-the-art black box. They encode, I don't know, colors, edges, who knows what, textures. We'll see. And the other thing, of course, is the ground truth data that we're using for training. So where does that come from? I mean, basically, it comes straight from Amazon. When you click on an item, they use, according to some tech report they wrote, the following algorithm to recommend complementary and substitutable items. All they do is take the item I you're looking at and the set of all other items, J, and they compute this quantity, which is called the Jaccard index. This is saying, what is the intersection between the sets of users who bought both items divided by the union of the sets of two users who bought both items. So think about that a little bit. Draw a Venn diagram in your heads. This is basically a number between 0 and 1. It's 0 if the two items were purchased by completely disjoint sets of people, and it's 1 if they were purchased by exactly the same set of people. All Amazon does is rank things by that quantity and returns you the things with the highest rank. So we collected that. Those are sort of positive instances we're going to use for training, plus a bunch of randomly selected pairs, most of which ought to be negative instances. Okay, so, sorry, I was writing on this before. I can't get rid of it now. Delete. Okay. So, the first, simplest kind of classifier we come up with is one that says, all right, I'm going to look at the raw similarity between these two visual features. Whichever two things have the most similar features are going to be the ones I consider to be related or that I think are likely to be co-purchased. We can do a little bit better and weight that by some theta. This model is basically a logistic regression. Yeah? I mean, these are features derived from one product image of that product. So they come directly from the pixels of the picture. Yeah, it's just an image representation for a single image, which is whatever the one Amazon shows first. Oh, no, XI is the ith image, and XIK is the kth feature in the ith image. Yeah. I mean, image features, who knows what they are. It's just some high-dimensional vector associated with each image. You could use anything else you want, though. It's just, these are the features associated with product I, these are the features associated with product J. You could concatenate the similarity between price, the similarity between average star rating, anything else you want about the product in there. But these ones just come directly from the images. So, yeah, simplest thing we can do is learn something like a weighted similarity. So this is the regular Euclidean distance between the two feature vectors for image I and image J, weighted by theta. So you can convince yourself this is just regular logistic regression by saying, all right, I'll take the probability that the two things are related, a 1 divided by 1 plus e to the negative of this expression, which is then equal to xi, xij in this instance, dot theta. All right, so this would be a simple logistic regression type model. It's a linear classification function. This is something we'd already know how to do. And, you know, it'll work okay, but it's this very, it's this sort of too restrictive notion of similarity, yeah? Yeah. This would be, I mean, it's a pairwise feature vector. So I'm just saying I could build some new feature, which is xij equals xi1 minus xj1, comma, xi squared, say, xi2 minus xj2 squared, so on and so forth. So it's a bit different from, I mean, so far you think about a feature matrix as being a matrix where each row is a single item. In this case, because I'm doing pairwise classification, I have a matrix where each row is the difference between a pair of items. So anyway, if we just learn a weighted similarity function, we're going to get some very overly simple notion of a visual similarity. We're going to say, how much should my pink shirt go with pink pants? How much should my striped shirt go with striped pants? How much should a Hawaiian shirt go with Hawaiian pants? Something like that. And at best, this will be able to recommend what's called a lounge suit, right? People know what a lounge suit is, where the pants sort of identically match. I mean, it's like you'll identify some very, very oversimplified notion of visual similarity. So we try and extend this by learning some more complicated parameter vector that considers pairs of features simultaneously, like to what extent should the color in one image be matched by a texture in another image. This is then like some super high-dimensional matrix that considers every feature in one image and compares it to every feature in the other image. That's kind of ridiculous if you have 4,000 dimensional features, because when you have 16 million parameters. So we try and simplify that by assuming that it has some sort of low-rank structure. So this is the model we actually fit. There's kind of a much more intuitive explanation for that, though. So we have these very high-dimensional image features, like 4,000 dimensions, and we'd like to project those into some low-dimensional space K. Yeah? What's that? Yeah. Yeah, basically, it's sort of, it's describing, I mean, this is called a Mahalanobis distance. Yeah, and it's something like the covariance of X. When we're learning X from, we're training M, we're not given M as input, but, okay, it's like saying, think of learning some ellipsoid, which says in which directions does the variance jointly move for these two dimensions in the, I don't know, there's a Wikipedia page. All right, so the sort of more intuitive version of the low rank version of this thing is that we're projecting our image features into some small number of dimensions K such that we can measure their Euclidean similarity. So we call this sort of style space. We're trying to find from these very high dimensional image features some small number of features that we can project into which correspond to this notion of a style, and then distance will correspond to Euclidean distance in that projected space. And we train it exactly as I described. We just fit that model. We try and maximize this likelihood. So highest probability for related things, lowest probability for non-related things. Yeah? So really what this looks like is the difference between the absolute value of u times xi minus xj. This is what we're trying to minimize. So, I mean, it's no longer a linear model, but you can think of this as being your feature for one pair, and this is your parameter for one pair. But I'm not just taking a linear combination of features anymore. I'm projecting my features and computing their norm. Anyway, how well does this whole thing work? Like, if we discover, say, 110 or 100 dimensions of like style, can we predict whether things would be co-purchased or co-browsed? For books, yeah, not very well. You can do it a little bit. Surprisingly, you can discover with about 74% accuracy whether two books would be bought together based on their cover images. So apparently you can find some kind of characteristic appearance. Works a little bit better for electronics, works sort of much better for clothing, of course. For something like shoes, you can predict with about 98% accuracy whether two shoes would be co-purchased based on how they look. All right, so what's going to be more interesting is saying what are the kind of dimensions we actually find from this model. So what are the different dimensions that most exhibit particular style in this projected space that we learn, and you find things like, I don't know, what's this? Rock music, clothes. There's some dimension that kind of measures how much does this clothing item exhibit like a a flannel or a plaid texture. Some are not just like one particular category, but this is measuring how pink is the item. This for men's clothing is measuring like how shiny is the item. It's apparently a feature people consider. So, you know, what do you think you get when you order CGI underwear? I have no idea. But it's something people consider anyway. You learn like dimensions that distinguish plain and very colorful watch faces. And you can also say, all right, for some particular notion of style, what items are sort of placed furthest apart that the model thinks would be very unlikely to be co-purchased. And then, you know, one dimension you find looks like this. You find that sort of flat shoes are placed very, very far apart by the model from things like high-heeled shoes. In other words, people who would purchase this would be very unlikely to purchase this. You can also use it to recommend outfits. So given some query, you can find a set of compatible things from different categories. So like if you search for a flannel shirt, it'll tell you you might want to buy track pants, balaclava, and some jack boots. Or, you know, all kinds of things for other categories on Amazon. You know, I'm not saying you should wear a camo Chevrolet shirt with leather vests, but it seems to be consistent with statistics of what people are doing. I think we're about out of time, though.
This has been a UC San Diego podcast. For more, visit podcast.ucsd.edu.